Welcome back. Hope everyone had a good weekend. Enjoyed it. Spent it thinking of power electronics.
So, as a reminder,
homework 2 has been posted. It'll be due Friday before class as usual. Well, subject to any changes announced in class, stick to that schedule throughout the semester. Homework due every Friday before class. And then homework 1 solutions have been posted. They're on the website. And I put the password in Canvas. Everybody see that, able to access them? No to seeing it? Okay. No problems there, at least, that we know of. Look through those. I post detailed solutions in grading assignments. I'll give less detailed feedback on your specific assignment as a result. Go look through the solution. Everything's all down. Questions on anything there?
Do you grade homework 1? Already graded, right?
No.
I'm not familiar with the UT online teaching system, so I don't know where. I don't know even.
Yeah, so it'll be posted in Canvas. Your graded assignment will be. So don't expect a lot of detail there. Just here's your score. Here's where you went wrong. Go look at the solutions if you need to. Make sure you do that. This class is cumulative, and it'll be expected that by the time we get to a midterm or a final, all of this stuff will be on there. So make sure you've understood any mistakes you made. Keep moving forward. Okay. So then today I'm going to finish up one thing on the intro that I didn't quite get to, is just an experimental example showing some real prototype waveforms. Go over this relatively quickly, and then we'll get into analysis of hard switching. So this was a, let's see here, 150 to 400 volt boost, 150, ran it up to 300 watts. Experimental example, just a simple boost converter at high voltage, and it was looking at the impact of using Schottky diodes on this type of converter. So running first with a silicon diode, switching frequency of 1 megahertz, and running it in this DCM operating mode that we looked at in the previous slides, you can see there is a very significant dead time or switching time. 15 to 20% of the overall period is just this resonant interval where the inductor current goes negative and brings the switch on voltage down. You can also see this fairly sinusoidal, kind of a quarter wave of a sinusoid segment in the switch node voltage resonating correspondingly with the inductor current. So this is original design with a high voltage silicon diode. You can see a little bit of the impact of reverse recovery. Even though we are soft switching, inductor current hits zero here, but the switch node voltage remains clamped until about this point. So during all of this time, we are just removing carriers, these stored minority carriers in the silicon diode, and getting it to actually shut off. There still is some impact of reverse recovery. It's going to be relatively mundane because of this soft switching type behavior. We have a very low DIDT, which, as we saw, reverse recovery depends on the amplitude of this DIDT. So we can remove those carriers with relatively low loss, but it'll still impact the operation, impact the efficiency. Number, just using this DCM compared to a CCM small ripple type case, we're increasing conduction losses by roughly 30% to get this 100% ripple, but perhaps getting rid of a significant portion of switching losses. Loss breakdown on this prototype, so you get a couple switching frequencies, 100 kilohertz, just 5.7 watts. And there is some impact of this reverse recovery mechanism, but still able to get 98.1% efficiency. As we go up to 10 times that in switching frequency, the losses shoot up and the efficiency drops, and reverse recovery is now kind of a dominant loss mechanism. With this minority carrier silicon PN diode, reverse recovery is our main limiting factor preventing us from going up higher frequency, result using smaller passives, having wider control bandwidth, other benefits that we can get out of high frequency. And then this should really be drawn as a Schottky. Replace that silicon diode with a silicon carbide Schottky diode, running the same type of waveforms. Running in DCM, you can see there's much smaller, if not negligible, delay between whenever the inductor current hits zero and when this drain to source voltage starts falling. That's the result of it being a Schottky type diode. We don't have to remove all these minority star charges. Look real closely. We'd also see this is a little bit shorter, this transition. That's it, just having a smaller capacitance on the diode than in the silicon case. Okay. Claimed on this silicon carbide diode because it's a Schottky type, B, that has no reverse recovery. That's a statement that's kind of true to first order. It is built as a Schottky type junction. If you get into detail on the actual fabrication of the silicon carbide diode, not purely metal end, it's got some P wells around the edge. It's how they do edge termination and make sure things don't arc off the side of the device. So it does actually have a little bit of a PN junction in there. It can contribute a little bit of reverse recovery charge, but the bulk of it is Schottky type, has more or less zero reverse recovery. So we go and test that and find that whether it's 100 kilohertz or 1 megahertz, we put it right in this DCM operating mode, there is almost no difference in efficiency. If we push it a little bit further at 2 megahertz, we start to see a little bit of drop. But we're down at this less than 5 watts, similar to the 100 kilohertz case in silicon, even up at 1 megahertz, or about there at 2 megahertz, just beginning to drop a little bit. The idea is that because we used the Schottky, we've more or less eliminated this reverse recovery loss mechanism, which is a good thing, allows us to run to higher frequency. Like I talked in the last class, it's like peeling away layers of an onion. So still, that doesn't allow us to go up to infinite frequency with no problem. Now some second order effects start taking over. Okay. Losses in the magnetics at higher frequency, really core loss in this case, and then second order switching loss mechanisms, things like parasitic inductances in the switching loop, like gate drive losses, things like just residual turn off losses. So all that one, just some example showing this DCM type soft switching operation providing some advantage and getting rid of reverse recovery being an important thing. Gives us a significant boost in efficiency, at least in the 1 megahertz case, went from 95 to 98.7 at 1 megahertz. Significant drop in losses. And then the next couple, just a couple of different studies just to set a reference frame for where high frequency is modern power electronics. So this is one paper that looked into using kind of best in class new really fast RF GaN FETs. How fast do we think we could really switch? This was running a 50 megahertz buck converter, just normal hard switch buck converter. Used a TriQuint. It's a GaNFET that was really designed for RF applications to be an amplifier, not a switching device. But as a result, is very small, has very low parasitics, has about 1-ish picofarad of capacitance. The figure of merit multiplying capacitance by Ron. Ron was on the order of an ohm. And about 1 picofarad of capacitance and really low gate charge in the picocoulombs range. And what this study found is use these as switching devices. They can be super fast switching. Here we see the VDS rise time, 750 picoseconds. Pushing up into this level of switching speed, it becomes really hard to debug and design these things. The reason is this device has a roughly 1 picofarad drain to source capacitance. And the probe used to measure this waveform has 4 picofarads of capacitance. So just measuring anything in the circuit quadruples the parasitics. and has a significant impact on efficiency. This thing would drop a few percentage points in efficiency just if you tried to measure any waveform while it was running. That's up in the 50 megahertz range. Are some other designs coming out of a number of different groups looking at even higher frequencies. This is just an example of one resonant converter designed to run at 110 megahertz and getting reasonable efficiency up close to 90%, range of 0 to 15 watts, with significant effort. The topology here is called a Phi-2 resonant converter. Basically is designed to be similar to the resonant boost that we showed at the end of our introduction. Got fully resonant waveforms as it shuts on and shuts off. And then it's got the addition of a little harmonic trap here. It makes the waveforms kind of, we saw VDS of the transistor look like this in that quasi-resonant boost converter that I showed. This Phi-2 thing, what it does is adds a third harmonic so that they look like this and just reduces those peak stresses a little bit. Otherwise, fairly similar to what we looked at before. Um, 110 megahertz, said fairly low efficiency, but still kind of in play, still reasonable to employ, but requiring significant effort on the design of the magnetics and the design of this overall converter, and needs to be operated very precisely at good operating points that'll get exact soft switching. If during a transient or because of some problem you lose soft switching, this thing will blow up pretty quickly. The switching losses, the switching energy goes up at all because of this high switching frequency, it'll be a big problem. It needs to be pretty precisely controlled. Just something we can do with modern digital control, but a consideration. So just to showing these two examples to kind of establish when we talk about pushing up to higher frequency, talking about going into the low megahertz range with traditional methods, into the tens or hundreds of megahertz with extreme effort, not much beyond that for a design that shows any significant benefit for a switching converter. Okay. Those are all very rough numbers, depends on the application. You find things that are higher, you can find things where really high frequency techniques are needed just to get to 100 kilohertz.
So they compare the size of this two converters?
I don't recall in this paper if they do. Generally, if you look at these, what you find is that this things in the 100 megahertz tend to be larger because you have to go to air core inductors. But there could still be some advantage in terms of these air core inductors can be made very thin. So maybe a very thin converter, even if the surface area is larger than what you would get for a 500 kilohertz, different form factor. But inductors for general purpose power, voltage, current levels tend to be pretty similar, that they can get smaller up into the low megahertz range. After that, you start to have to say, throw out all these ferrites because they won't work anymore. The core loss is too high. Use either very low permeability materials or air cores, and then the inductors have to start getting bigger to get the inductance you want. So it's kind of up to about a megahertz, you end up getting smaller and smaller physically. And then somewhere in the high megahertz to tens of megahertz starts to come back that okay, they're getting bigger again to keep reasonable efficiency. Kind of the knee of that Pareto front that we talked about last time tends to be 10 megahertz-ish. All depends on specifics, but roughly that range. This would be past it. This would be using either taking a hit in efficiency, which a lot of these inductors were just commercial. Maybe part of why their efficiency was a little bit lower. Shown some higher efficiency designs, but they have very large air core toroidal inductors.
Why we don't talk about the capacitors when we talk about power electronics? So we focus on the switch, the inductor, the transformer. We don't talk about capacitors. Why?
We will talk about capacitors at some length in this course because we're going to talk about switch capacitor converters soon. Have no inductors in them. traditionally we don't, because in the range of most applications that we talk about with power electronics, inductors are a lot harder to design than capacitors until you get up to many kilovolts. It's a lot easier to create a near ideal insulator than it is to create a near ideal conductor. The same reason we, you know, worry about copper all the time, but we don't worry about the insulation so much. Start to get up to utility level applications, that flips. It's easy to have a good conductor. You have 100 kilovolts and a small current. But down in our range, inductors tend to be lossier and larger. Capacitors, you tend to be able to buy something that works pretty well just off the shelf, as long as you make the right considerations. You do have to think about the ESR, the cap, and what dielectric material to use for your application. You tend to do okay. Also, just where the state of technologies is, dielectric materials we know, the core materials and conductors we know, over again a certain range where most power electronics applications are, capacitors are much higher energy density than inductors. Like a 1206 cap might have comparable energy storage capability to an inductor that's a cubic inch. Rough numbers, been a few studies comparing that, but tends to be that the capacitors can be quite small to do their job and quite low loss. Inductors cannot, are more of a constraining factor. And all of this discussion is constrained to majority of applications. Start designing something for the transmission grid, all of that's going to flip suddenly. Very high switching frequency is 25 kilohertz. Capacitors are gigantic and a huge problem. Insulation is the majority of your concern in that. This is all talking about power supplies up to maybe kilovolts rating and some tens to hundreds of kilowatts. Does that answer your question? Make sense? No, it doesn't?
Yes, it makes sense.
Okay, cool. Any other questions on any of this? All right, so for the remainder of the course, what are we going to do? We're going to cover these sorts of topics. There's just some background on high-frequency power conversion. The first thing we're going to do is just go over analysis of switching loss and some approximate equations, and then we'll delve into analyzing resonance being employed for the purpose of soft switching converters or fully resonant converters. Very briefly about magnetics design. That's a whole topic unto itself. And then we'll remain in the class talking about some different types of converters, non-resonant soft switching converters, ones where we use resonance just during the switching time to try to get this soft switching behavior, and then resonant converters where we have resonant waveforms during the entire period. Talk a little bit about applications, practical issues, and we'll also stick in here. I don't even have it on my listing, but we'll talk about switch capacitor converters as well, being in a wholly different class of converter designs where we get away from inductors and have different switching mechanisms. And that'll carry us through the end of the semester. If you know all this stuff, you're done. So we're going to start with just talking about hard switch converters, just to establish a baseline, understand where these losses that we're trying to eliminate come from. And just analysis, as I kind of mentioned previously, of hard switching is very difficult because we have many different effects going on at once. The gate driver's ability to drive the FET, what that waveform looks like, is happening at the same time that there's energy dissipated in the channel. It's happening at the same time parasitic inductance and output capacitance that are resonating, causing ringing waveforms. We'll kind of look at individual mechanisms one at a time so we can understand roughly what is the kind of order of magnitude impact on energy loss. A lot of these equations won't be super accurate if you're actually hard switching. They're going to consider one mechanism at a time. More useful for design, saying, okay, which of these mechanisms do I have to get rid of to get an efficiency I want, more so than actually predicting what the efficiency is going to be very accurately. It's more of a goal of understanding where the losses come from and kind of what magnitude they might be in your design than specifically predicting them. Okay. So we're going to begin by just talking about synchronous switching. being having two different actively controlled switching devices, two transistors we can control when they turn on. And then really all traditional PWM converters, we end up with a switching cell that looks like this, sometimes called inductively clamped switching. Which is really just looking at, I've got a fixed voltage across my devices. Some circuit connecting here, which I can assume within the switching time is just a constant DC voltage across these FETs. And a clamped current going into the switching node that has to, during the switching action, commutate between the two devices going through. One of them, by the end of the switching action, has to be going through the other one. Obvious that this is a boost, and if I flip it around, it's a buck. But also, if you take something like a Chuuk or a Cepic, all this is still going to apply. If it was a Chuuk, there might be some series capacitor here, but during the switching time, it's just a DC voltage offset. So all the dynamics will look the same. Okay. All these traditional PWM topologies, with some reduction in circuit possibly, go to this type of circuit, have this same type of analysis. So when I switch this thing, let's give some names here. Call this M1, and I'm going to draw its VGS waveform up here. I'll say it's conducting at the beginning of the period. When I shut it off, and then I'll turn it back on over here for one complete switching period. And then I'm going to sketch my other device, M2, VGS will be inverted. And I'm going to leave some of these dead times that we've talked about to make sure that I don't turn both devices on at the same time. Label these TD1, TD2. These are my dead times. That are required to make sure that I don't ever have both devices on at the same time. And dead times have to be designed carefully. In most cases, we want them as small as possible, but have to be aware that setting them at zero or near zero may cause problems because I can't turn these devices on or off instantaneously. So the actual dead time in terms of how long both devices are fully in cutoff may actually be different than my programmed dead time or when my PWM signal tells them to turn on and off. And what I mean by that is if I kind of zoom in on one of these dead times and look at my waveforms, let's do this second one, got VGS2. It's high. And then at this time, my controller PWM signal goes low. So my controller is telling this device to shut off. And ideally, it would just drop down to zero instantaneously. But because of these capacitances that we've mentioned before, and we'll talk about in more detail, I can't turn it off instantaneously. Instead, what I'll get is some kind of waveform, perhaps something like this, where it takes some amount of time before that thing gets to zero. Driving it, got some stored capacitance, there's some resistance of the circuit, I'm not going to be able to drive it instantaneously. So I can decide here what I really care about and at what point I'm really going to call this thing off. It's an RC circuit, it should kind of decay exponentially, and that may be infinite if I want to say, oh, fully zero in mathematical sense. But I'll kind of say, maybe we just pick somewhere here where it hits its threshold voltage and call that fully off once it gets below the threshold. What does that mean? If I program in some very small dead time, say, I left 10 picoseconds between when I shut off VGS2, and when I turn on VGS1, very possible that I'll accidentally get both devices above threshold for some amount of time.
And I have a similar type waveform when I turn on VGS1. And what I'd like to do is, at minimum, time this out so that they both cross their threshold at the same time. And that'd be my theoretical minimum dead time, such that I don't end up with both devices conducting significant current at the same time. So tell me, somewhere like here is where I want to do PWM of M1 goes high.
And sketching this all out just to show, okay, I would have programmed in this amount of dead time right here. This is what my controller is dictating is the dead time. It's setting those PWM signals this amount of time apart. But actually, in terms of when both devices are not conducting, I have zero dead time, right? They both hit the threshold at the exact same moment. And if I had gone any shorter on this time, I would still have programmed, I've told my PWM to give it some dead time. And the switching signals, the PWM waveforms driving these would have some dead time between them, but the actual devices wouldn't. Okay. So be careful in implementation that you may actually have to program in a dead time than what you get in the circuit. Generally, how far apart your switching signals, your gate drive signals need to be, larger than what you actually get in the power state. Okay. Make sense? So let's say we put that in, then what happens in the actual switching circuit? Let's look at the switch node voltage. So everything outside of the dead time should be real clear. When VGS1 is on, I get VDC because the high side device is on. When M2 turns on, I get nearly zero. Some ILR on type drop across it. We'll neglect that for the moment. But then the question becomes, what happens during these dead times? And I'll assume for the moment that inductor is large, we can model it as a constant current. VDC is constant, both of these are just DC. With that assumption, what actually happens during these switching dead times? Answer is, well, it really depends on what IL is. So either of these dead times, we're gonna end up shutting off both devices and having some circuit that looks like constant current IL going into the switch node. And after I shut one device off and the other device hasn't turned on yet, all I'll be left with in the circuit here is really the capacitances of these two devices, CDS1, CDS2. And so IL is in the polarity drawn, it's gonna tend to want to increase the switch node voltage. The current is gonna split between these two devices, flow this direction, charging CDS2 and bringing the switch node voltage up, and it's going to flow this direction, discharging CDS1 and bringing the switch node voltage closer to VDC.
Okay. Now both switch are in off state, right?
Right. So we'll neglect a little bit as we're turning off on these waveforms and say, okay, zoomed out, approximate these as more or less vertical lines and just look at in between these dashed lines here. What happens when both switches are fully off? Okay.
So if
I reverse the polarity of IL and it's flowing the other way, this is all going to flip, right? All of my little orange arrows here are going to go the opposite direction. Instead of increasing V switch, I'm going to drop it down. Again, flowing through both of these capacitances. And that circuit will exist until I switch some device, either intentionally or unintentionally. I do have body diodes on both of these devices inherently. It will turn on if I try to send the switch node voltage below zero or above VDC. Or this interval takes too long, it'll end whenever I turn on the next device. So let's start with the case where IL is greater than zero. So I have a positive current constant during this interval flowing in the direction shown, left to right. What's going to happen here? So I shut off both of these devices, and this current IL tends to want to increase the switch node voltage. So switch node voltage is going to start increasing, and very quickly, this body diode is going to turn on and clamp it. And I'll spend the entirety of this dead time just with that body diode conducting the full inductor current until the end of it when I turn on M2 and rip that voltage down with all the associated switching loss. M1 body diode conducts. During the second dead time, I'm starting at zero. If I still have positive inductor current, it's going to tend to want to increase this voltage. So as soon as I shut off, I'm going to see the voltage increase with a slope of IL over 2 CDS. The inductor current flowing and it's splitting between these two capacitances do kind of an AC equivalent. They're effectively in parallel because VDC and ground are zero small signal AC nodes. And exactly what this waveform depends on the magnitude of IL and CDS and how long this time interval is. So I drew something here where it increases for a while. Then at the end of this interval, M1 turns on, and again, this will get shorted up to VDC and have some associated switching loss. If IL was smaller, I might get something that looks like this. Doesn't make it quite as far and then get shorted up. If it was a really nice value, I get a waveform that looks like that, where during the dead time it makes it exactly from zero to VDC, exactly where I want it to be when the device turns on, and the device turns on with zero voltage across it. And if I had even a little bit higher inductor current, what happened is this would shoot up, and then forward bias the body diode as it crosses VDC before the end of the dead time. This arrow here as well. Right. Which of those waveforms I get depends on the IL, CDS, and the dead time. Higher IL or smaller CDS will make it go up faster, and then the dead time needs to be long enough for it to go through the entire waveform. Okay. Contrast, if IL is less than zero, during the dead time IL is flowing this direction, or it's a CCM buck converter, these two dead times are just going to get swapped. We'll see the exact opposite thing now. IL less than zero means the inductor current wants to discharge the switch node, pull energy out of CDS2 and put it in CDS1. Means in this first one, we'll get a flip version of what we drew before. A depends on the magnitude of the inductor current, whether we have any body diode conduction, whether we have any
heart switching at the end of the period. And in the second interval, we'll just conduct through the body dialed the whole time. Okay, so what do we want ideally? Body diode conduction is obviously going to cause additional losses. We're going to have the inductor current going through a forward voltage, higher conduction loss. So we'd like to avoid as much diode conduction as we can. We have one of these waveforms like the green one here, where we're just body diode conducting the whole time, and the best we can do is make that interval as short as possible. Going down to the minimum dead time such that we don't conduct both devices at the same time. If we have an interval like the green one here, where we have possibility to achieve zero voltage switching, what we'd like to do is time things out such that the switch node voltage waveform exactly reaches zero right when we turn on the device. Or exactly reaches VDC in the second interval here, right before we turn on the device. Time it out so that IL over 2 CDS will take us from 0 to VDC exactly in TDT. We don't have any capacitive energy lost. Won't have any additional body diode connection. In terms of switching energy, maybe our minimum. In terms of overall efficiency, the converter depends on how that impacts other things in our operation. But just looking at the switching energy, that would minimize it here. That make sense? Okay. So then from here, what we're going to do is start talking about the actual switching mechanisms in detail. Kind of related to why did I draw the VGS waveform in this way. Remember how I do this. Up here, and it drew a pretty specific wave shape and what's actually happening during the switching of the device as the VGS is dropping or rising. And to do so, I just want to briefly review what's going on inside a MOSFET in both the conducting and non-conducting states. So here's my cross-section of what we call a VDMOS, or a standard vertical power MOSFET along the fusion region. Many variants of this, things could be done a little bit differently. It should be kind of a standard structure though. Hey, looking at this kind of hatch region is all metal. This stuff with the small dots in it is some sort of oxide. It's just a insulator between the gate and the rest of the FET. And then this white region up top would be our gate. That's either metal or polysilicon, depending on the technology. Polysilicon, not a great conductor, will lead to a little bit higher gate resistance, but a little bit easier to get it real close down to the actual silicon. Metal, better conductor, but requires a little bit more technology to be able to get it down close. A little bit more cost as a result. Right. And then what we create to get a power MOSFET is really just a ton of small MOSFETs, small vertical MOSFETs in parallel. So kind of a single unit cell would be this here. And then I've got those paralleled in two dimensions ad nauseum to create a big power device. Okay. So every individual cell is built to block the full voltage. You'll see the full drain to source voltage across it, but it only conducts a very small portion of the current. With many thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of these in parallel to all share the current. Okay. So what do we have? Main source on top, as we've said before, turn this thing on, I pull the gate high, creates a potential between the gate and the source, pulling in electrons to create an inversion layer right under the gate. The only P-type region So creating this inversion layer gives me a conduction path. Inversion layer. And once I create that, I have a continuous conduction path through N-type materials.
Going like this through the cell.
All the gates are all shorted together. You kind of see on the side here trying to show that. I'm driving all the gates simultaneously, and then from the metal on the bottom and on the top, all the drains, all the sources are shorted together. So all these things turn on at the same time and conduct ideally equally. A bunch of tricks to play in terms of thermal matching and boundary matching to make sure that everyone kind of sees the same conditions and current sharing is as good as you can get it. See what else. We've got the P-type body here. This is where the channel is formed. That's directly shorted to the source by this metal. You can see the metal goes across both this N plus well and the P body well. So we source and body are shorted together internally. It's a three-terminal device and does result in this body diode between the body and drain. But since it's shorted to the source, we see between the source and drain in our three-terminal model. That body diode becomes significant when we start talking about how this thing operates in cutoff. So this is all, okay, when it's on, some positive VGS greater than threshold to get this channel and have it conduct, this inversion layer in the channel. When we shut it off, what we're really going to be concerned about is capacitances of the device. So here is MOSFET shut off, VGS is approximately zero, so effectively shorted the gate and source together, or have some small voltage less than the threshold. And what we really get out of it is just a bunch of capacitances between every different conducting material. So let's talk about the easy ones first. This gate to source from the gate polysilicon to the source metal. It's just some big parallel plate capacitor. The capacitance across this oxide insulator over the entire surface area of all the gate and all the metal. It's just some big distributed parallel plate capacitor. So that's going to be just a roughly constant capacitance. I'll look mostly at what happens as I change the drain to source voltage. So a couple other easy ones in this case. From the gate to this N well, there's some capacitance, and that's just based on the physical structure of the device. From the gate to the P-type body, some additional capacitance. All of those are with respect to VDS changing, just more or less constant capacitances. And the total gate to source capacitance that we see measured on this device when it's in cutoff would be the sum of those three in parallel. I mean, gate conductor and anything that's connected to the source.
We'll have CGS equal to CGSM plus CGSN plus CGSP constant as VDS changes.
Some second order effects there. That's just more or less a simple capacitance. The ones that are going to be a little more interesting is what's going on with CDS and CGD. Both of these are capacitances that go to the drain. And to get to the drain from the source or the gate, all I have to do is jump across this large depletion region. Depletion region is formed across the junction of the body diode, and it's where this external voltage is all blocked. Right? Semiconductor physics is I put a large electric field across this. What happens? It ends up right at this PN junction. Expanding from that point, I end up with all of the carriers getting pushed out. I'm left with bound charges in this depletion region, but no free carriers. That depletion region has no free carriers, is insulating and block voltage across it. It blocks voltage by exposing these bound minority carrier charges.
got a bunch of free electrons in my n-type material. Those all get pushed out. What I'm left with is a net positive charge sitting there. Positive charge blocks the external voltage. Okay. This junction is between, I don't really see it here, the P plus body and the N minus epitaxial region. So the depletion region expands far into this N type region because it's lightly doped. It's got to go a long way to reveal a significant amount of charge. It expands a short amount of way, short distance into this P type, P plus region. But depletion region is what's blocking the voltage, and because it's depleted of charges, it is insulating. So this CDS and CGD capacitance, they look like a parallel plate capacitance. It's like a CGD, it's the capacitance between kind of the bottom of the gate here and the edge of this depletion region. I have my free carriers build up if it was a conducting plate. But as I block higher and higher voltages, this depletion region expands. And it has to reveal more charge to block the higher external electric field. It means that it looks like a parallel plate capacitor, but those two plates are getting further away as the voltage goes up. And that's why we get this nonlinear capacitance that I showed in some of the previous plots that we'll analyze in some detail later. Because this depletion region is expanding with voltage, the capacitance is dropping with voltage. Bigger distance between the two ends of it. Same thing with CDS. CDS is a little bit larger. CGD just has kind of this gate. Oops. Conductor. CDS would have all of this. And it would be the capacitance between, you know, these two quote unquote parallel plates. CDS would be a little bit larger capacitance, but will also be nonlinear. As the drain to source voltage goes up, plates get further apart and the capacitance drops. So both CDS and CGD are functions of VDS. That's the nonlinear capacitances because the capacitance changes with voltage. Things are going to come into play both in terms of looking at how we turn on the gate and looking at how much energy we lose when we don't soft switch them, or the waveforms when we do soft switch them. Questions on that?
If the MOSFETs are designed to break to block the higher voltage, so the layer will be go higher.
So, right. You have kind of two options. So the maximum voltage that you can block in the limit is dictated by when this depletion region expands out and hits the edge of the device. Okay. So if it expands out and hits the metal, it's going to break down. You no longer keep expanding up through into the conductor. So blocking voltage capability is really dictated by what is your total stored charge here. Which you can get by either more lightly doping or expanding the length of it. There is a parameter of a material called the critical electric field, which is how much electric field the silicon can withstand before it breaks down. You dope more heavily, you can make this depletion region smaller, but you still have to block the same electric field, so it's going to result in a higher peak electric field. You dope more lightly, it expands that voltage drop over a longer distance and gives you a smaller peak electric field. The breakdown will really occur right at the junction here. The electric field goes up to the junction and drops back down on the other side with the opposite polarity of stored charge. And that leads to this trade-off I mentioned earlier. To block higher voltage, you have to end up making the resistance per unit cell higher. To block higher voltage, you either make it taller, which makes this conduction path longer, or you dope more lightly, which makes it more resistive. You get whatever resistance you want by paralleling more of these unit cells, but that eventually becomes really costly or has a whole lot of stored charge. Again, looking at a unit cell, all these capacitances are in parallel with every other unit cell. But more in parallel, the resistance goes down, but all the capacitances go up.
Oh, what's the typical size of this?
These tend to be bigger than of the die.
Yeah.
The die maybe, you know, depends on the voltage and resistance, but maybe very small, up to a few millimeters by a few millimeters. Up to, for utility applications, some of these hockey puck style SCTs may be like inches of actual die. Cost shoots up rapidly with that. As you're creating anything in silicon, you're going to get defects here and there. So if you take one wafer and you can put a million MOSFETs on it, and you have 10 defects, then 10 of your million MOSFETs get thrown out. Take one wafer and put one MOSFET on it, and it has 10 defects, the whole thing is trash and you have to throw it out. So the bigger the die, the more expensive it's going to be, both because it's more material, but also because you're going to get lower yield. Each one is going to be more expensive. It's going to take getting less of them produced each time you actually run through the manufacturing process. I'm out of time, so we're not going to fully go through this until next class, but I do want to make sure everybody knows the equation here, because you do need it on your homework. So as you turn on the gate of the MOSFET, you're going to have a power loss that looks like VDR times QGFS. We will show why and derive that next class. What this means is, from the actual gate driver itself, this is the amount of power that is supplied just to get the VGS voltage to go from 0 to wherever it ends up. If I want to get it from 0 to 10 volts, then I need roughly 17 nanocoulombs of QG. And that's supplied from VDR, which is the power supply voltage for the gate driver. My gate driver has a 10 volt supply, then when I turn it fully on, the output should be 10 volts. And from that supply, to get the gate to turn on, I need this amount of charge coming off that supply to go into the gate to get me to 10 volts. Then when I shut off the gate, I mentioned briefly earlier, I'm going to short out and dissipate all of this charge. Okay. So if I wanted to drive to 10 volts, I need 17 nanocoulombs. If I wanted to drive to 6 volts, I need 11 nanocoulombs. In each case, I have 6 volts times 11 nanocoulombs times FS loss, or 10 volts times 17 nanocoulombs times FS type loss associated with turning on and off that one MOSFET. Okay. We'll start here next class and say exactly where this equation comes from, what this driving process looks like. But if you want to get started on the homework, this is the equation that you'll need on the flyback problem. It kind of compares trade-offs in gate loss versus conduction loss. All right, we'll see everybody Wednesday. Thanks, everyone.